Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're diving into something truly massive, a project that reshaped not just a river, but geography and history. China's Three Gorges Dam. It's famous, of course, as the world's largest power station by capacity. But its story, well, goes back almost 100 years. And this isn't just about the engineering marvel, the concrete, the power. It's a really complex story. Huge costs, massive environmental changes, and millions of human lives affected.
Exactly. Our goal today is really to unpack this whole thing. We'll look at the history, the sheer size of it, the economics, how it makes all that power, and also the really clever ways they figured out how to get ships past it. And then, of course, the big one, the environmental and social side, which is, well, often pretty controversial.
Right. And we'll guide you through all those different angles, the facts, the surprising bits, so you come away really understanding the scale and stakes. So let's start way back. An idea this huge. It feels modern, but you said the roots are old. Where did it actually come from?
Yeah, surprisingly old. It wasn't a sudden thing. Sun Yat-sen, back in 1919, he first talked about a big dam on the Yangtze. He imagined something generating 22 gigawatts. I mean, that's incredible for 1919. Then the nationalist government did some preliminary work in 1932. And jump ahead to 1944, John L. Savage, he was the head design engineer for the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. He surveyed the area. He actually drew up a whole Yangtze River project proposal. And his plan had this really unique idea for ships.
Oh, yeah. What was that?
Giant cranes. The idea was these enormous cranes would lift groups of ships from one lock level to the next.
Cranes lifting ships. At 1944, that sounds ambitious, almost fantastical.
It really does, doesn't it? It shows the scale of thinking even then. That specific crane idea, well, it didn't happen, but the dream of the dam stuck around. After 1949, Mao Zedong was a big supporter. He even wrote a poem about it in 1956, Swimming, mentioning a dam. But then things like the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, they caused huge delays. It wasn't smooth sailing. And by the 1980s, you started seeing real opposition cropping up, especially in the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference.
Opposition even then.
Definitely. But despite that, the National People's Congress approved it in 1992. Though, interestingly, the vote was quite divided for such a major project. Only about 67.75% approval. That's 1,767 for, 177 against, and a lot of abstentions, 664, plus 25 who didn't vote at all. Quite low for China at the time.
That is unusually low. What were the main sticking points for those who opposed or abstained? Was it mostly the cost or something else?
It was largely the things we'll get into later, the huge environmental impact and, critically, the displacement of so many people. Those were big, big concerns debated at the time. But in the end, the arguments for flood control and all that power generation carried the day. And from that approval, well, things moved into high gear. Construction started.
Right. And this is where the scale just becomes staggering. Let's talk about the dam itself, the physical structure.
It's truly a monster of concrete and steel. Construction kicked off December 14th, 1994. The main dam structure itself was finished in 2006. The power plant got fully up and running by 2012. And then the ship lift, that was the last major piece, finished in 2015. Dimensions. Okay, it's 2,335 meters long. That's nearly a mile and a half. And the top is 185 meters above sea level. That's over 600 feet.
A mile and a half long.
Yeah. And the materials. 27.2 million cubic meters of concrete, mostly for the wall, and 463,000 tons of steel. Someone calculated that's enough steel for, get this, 63 Eiffel Towers.
63. Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
It is. Plus, they moved over 100 million cubic meters of earth. The actual wall, measured from its rock foundation, is 181 meters high, almost 600 feet.
Okay, the structure itself is immense.
Yeah.
But then there's the reservoir it creates. That's a whole other level of scale, isn't
it? Oh, absolutely. When it's full, which is at 175 meters elevation, the reservoir backs up for 660 kilometers. That's 410 miles.
400 miles.
And it's over a kilometer wide on average. It holds 39.3 cubic kilometers of water. That's, well, a staggering amount. It covers over 1,000 square kilometers of surface area. And importantly, it flooded 632 square kilometers of land that was previously, well, not underwater.
Okay, so this colossal undertaking inevitably brings up the question of money. How much did it cost and how is it paid for? And what are the power, the economic engine driving this?
Right, the economics. The initial government estimate was around 180 billion yuan. That was roughly 22.5 billion US dollars back then. By the end of 2008, the actual spending reported was about 148 billion yuan, a huge chunk for construction, obviously, but also a massive amount for relocating all those people, over 68 billion yuan just for that. And financing costs, too.
So, a bit under the initial estimate by that point.
Seems so, based on those 2008 figures. The really interesting part, though, is the cost recovery. They projected it would pay for itself after generating 1,000 terawatt hours of electricity, bringing in about 250 billion yuan. And incredibly, they hit that target by December 20th, 2013. So it recouped its costs relatively quickly through power generation.
That is fast. Where did the initial funding come from?
It was a mix. There was a specific Three Gorges Dam construction fund, profits from another big dam nearby, the Gazuba Dam, plus loans, bonds, and selling the power itself. They even had specific electricity surcharges. Provinces getting the power paid a bit extra per megawatt hour. Others paid a smaller surcharge except for Tibet.
Okay, so a dedicated funding stream and quick returns. Now, the power itself, we know it's the biggest, but what does that actually mean in terms of generation?
It means a lot of power. China Yangtze Power manages it. It has 34 generators in total, 32 main ones, each rated at 700 megawatts, plus two smaller 50 megawatt ones for the plant's own needs. That adds up to a total installed capacity of 22,500 megawatts. That's the world record.
22,500 megawatts.
Yep. And its output reflects that. In 2018, for instance, it generated 101.6 terawatt hours. It hit a record in 2020, 111.8 terawatt hours. That actually beat the previous world record held by the Itaipu Dam. Just for comparison, that's about 20 times the annual generation of the Hoover Dam.
20 times Hoover Dam. That's mind-boggling.
It really is. Each main generator, by the way, weighs about 6,000 tons. They use Francis turbines, which are really efficient, average over 94%, sometimes up to 96.5% efficiency. The electricity is generated at 20 kilovolts, then stepped way up to 500 kilovolts for long-distance transmission.
When did it all come online? Was it gradual?
It was. The first generator on the north side started spinning in July 2003. The south side was fully operational by October 2008, and the very last main generator started up in May 2012. That's when it hit the full 22.5 gigawatt capacity.
And where does all that power go?
It's distributed to 9 provinces and 2 major cities. Initially, there was a flat rate, but that changed in 2008 to variable pricing depending on the region. Interestingly, though, when it was planned, it was expected to supply maybe 10% of China's electricity needs.
Only 10%? That seems low for the world's biggest power plant.
Well, that just shows you how incredibly fast China's energy demand was growing, and still is. By 2011, even this behemoth only accounted for about 1.7% of China's total consumption.
Wow. That really puts China's growth into perspective. Even the world's largest dam is just a fraction of their needs.
Exactly. It's less about the dam underperforming and more about the sheer scale of China's energy appetite.
Okay, so massive power generation. But another huge aspect was navigation. Keeping the Yangtze River, this major artery, open for shipping. How did they tackle that huge barrier?
That was a key goal, absolutely. They wanted to massively increase shipping capacity from about 10 million tons a year up to 100 million tons and cut transport costs, make it safer too. They used a couple of really impressive engineering solutions. First, the ship locks.
Right, like giant staircases for ships.
Pretty much. There are two sets of locks, side by side. Each lock has 5 stages, or steps. It takes a ship about 4 hours to get all the way through. They can handle pretty big vessels, up to 10,000 tons. And the amount of cargo going through is immense, almost 160 million tons in 2022.
Hmm.
What's neat is they have separate staircases for going up and going down, which actually helps save water compared to a single two-way system.
4 hours. That's still quite a while. But then there's the other thing, the ship lift. That sounds even more advanced.
It really is. It's basically a giant elevator for ships. It can lift vessels up to 3,000 tons.
An elevator. How high does it lift them?
It lifts them 113 meters vertically. That's 371 feet, straight up or down. The basin the ship sits in is 120 meters long, 18 wide. And the best part, transit time is only 30 to 40 minutes. Huge difference compared to the locks.
30 minutes versus 4 hours. That's significant.
Massive difference for smaller, quicker traffic. It's designed to cope with big water level changes, too, on both the upstream and downstream sides. It uses a complex helical gear system. The total moving mass, including the ship, the water, and the counterweights, is around 34,000 tons. It's an engineering marvel.
When did that come online?
It was completed in January 2016, and the first actual cargo ship used it in July of that year.
And I think I read something about railways, too.
Yeah, that's the third part of the plan, though maybe less realized so far.
Right.
Portage railways. Two short rail lines planned, one north, one south of the dam area, to let cargo bypass the locks and lift entirely. Preliminary work apparently started back in late 2012, but it's not as prominent as the locks and the lift.
Okay, so incredible engineering for power and navigation. But this is where we get to the other side of the coin. A project this enormous, it inevitably has huge consequences beyond the direct benefits. Let's get into the environmental and the human costs.
Yes, and they are significant. Let's start with the environment. Even though hydropower is often called green, the construction and the flooding had major impacts. Just displacing coal, the power generated from 2003-2007 was equivalent to burning 84 million tons of coal. But the bigger issues are maybe erosion and sediment.
How so?
Well, about 80% of the land in the wider dam area is prone to erosion. Around 40 million tons of sediment used to flow down the Yangtze each year. Now, because the water flow above the dam is much slower, a lot of that sediment just settles out in the reservoir.
Right, so less sediment gets downstream. What does that cause?
Several problems. Downstream riverbanks, without that constant replenishment of silt, become more vulnerable to erosion and flooding themselves. And critically, places like Shanghai, which is way downstream, like 1,600 kilometers away, sits on a delta built up by that sediment over centuries. Less sediment means that delta is potentially more vulnerable to sea level rise and sinking. Also, the sediment that does settle in the reservoir can smother habitats on the riverbed, which is bad for aquatic life.
And landslides. I remember hearing about those.
Yes, a major issue. The rising and falling water levels in the reservoir destabilize the slopes along the edge. There have been frequent, sometimes major, landslides. You mentioned those two in May 2009, tens of thousands of cubic meters of rock and earth falling in. And in early 2010, there were nearly 100 significant landslides recorded in just 4 months.
That sounds incredibly dangerous for people living nearby.
It is a constant risk they have to monitor. Now, waste management is another angle. The project did push for upgrades. Over 50 new wastewater treatment plants were built upstream, dozens of new landfills too. But there's still over 1 billion tons of wastewater estimated to be released into the river annually. And because the water in the reservoir is slower moving, more stagnant, pollution tends to concentrate. The water is often described as murky, polluted.
So treatment upgrades, but still a massive pollution load in slower water.
Exactly. And forest cover was also impacted. It dropped significantly in the Three Gorges area over the decades leading up to the dam, though China did start major reforestation programs later, especially after big floods in 1998 highlighted the problem of deforestation.
What about wildlife? Rivers are usually biodiversity hotspots.
The Yangtze certainly was and is incredibly rich. Over 6,000 plant species, many endangered, hundreds of animal species. But the dam has hit freshwater fish populations hard. Changes in water temperature, the altered flow patterns, and just the physical danger of the turbines. It's tough for fish. The basin has 361 fish species, and about a quarter of China's endangered freshwater fish live there.
And some species haven't survived.
Tragically, no. The Beiji, the Chinese river dolphin, functionally extinct, likely gone completely. And the Chinese paddlefish, another ancient, unique species, was declared extinct in 2022. It hadn't been reliably sighted since 2003, right around when the reservoir started filling.
That's heartbreaking. Extinction is so final.
It is. And other species are affected, too. Siberian cranes lost crucial wintering wetlands. The Yangtze sturgeon is also negatively impacted.
And any effects beyond the river system itself?
Well, there are some more esoteric ones. NASA scientists calculated the sheer weight of the water shifted in the reservoir would minutely slow the Earth's rotation, increasing the length of a day by 0.06 microseconds.
Wow, that's wild.
And make the Earth bulge slightly more at the equator. There was also a study suggesting the water mass might affect the local gravity field enough to potentially influence seismic activity in nearby regions like Sichuan.
Okay, profound environmental changes. Now, the human side, the displacement. The numbers are huge.
They are. Estimates vary slightly, but it's generally accepted that somewhere between 1.13 million and 1.4 million people were moved. 13 cities, 140 towns, over 1,300 villages, all either partially or completely flooded by the reservoir.
1 million people forced to move. How did the government justify that?
The primary justification was always the downstream flood protection. Protecting potentially tens of millions from catastrophic floods was presented as the greater good. But the reality for many displaced people was harsh. Reports suggest living conditions deteriorated for a significant number. Many struggled to find comparable work or farmland in the resettlement areas. Older generations, especially farmers tied to their land, were hit particularly hard. It's a complex picture, though.
How so?
Well, some sources suggest that for younger generations, being moved to newly built, more modern towns or cities actually opened up different opportunities, better schools, different kinds of jobs. So while disruptive and difficult, the outcome wasn't uniformly negative across all demographics, but the scale is undeniable. By June 2008, official figures said 1.24 million people had been relocated.
It's a stark reminder of the trade-offs involved in these mega projects.
Mm-hmm.
Good intentions, like flood control, meeting these incredibly complex, often painful realities on the ground.
Yeah.
But let's focus on that flood control aspect, because that was arguably the main driver. Has it delivered?
Yes, that was the number one stated goal. Taming the Yangtze's devastating floods. Protecting downstream cities like Wuhan, Nanjing, Shanghai, plus huge areas of farmland and industry. The reservoir has a dedicated flood storage capacity of 22 cubic kilometers. The idea is to reduce the frequency of major floods downstream from something expected maybe once a decade down to once a century, and to lessen the impact of even the biggest superfloods.
And has it worked in practice?
There's strong evidence it has. You have to remember the history. The 1954 flood was catastrophic. Killed over 33,000 people, displaced nearly 19 million. Wuhan was underwater for months. The 1998 floods caused billions in damage. Since the dam, there have been major flood seasons where it clearly played a crucial role. In August 2009, for example, it held back a huge amount of water, cutting the peak flow downstream significantly. Same again during massive floods in July 2010. Inflows hit 70,000 cubic meters per second, a huge volume, but the dam restricted the outflow to 40,000, preventing what could have been a major disaster downstream.
So real-world evidence of it mitigating major flood events, that's a powerful argument.
It absolutely is. And it's not just about holding back floodwaters. It also helps manage water supply during the dry season.
How does that work?
Between December and March, typically the dry part of the year, the dam releases water stored in the reservoir. This increases the flow downstream when it's needed for agriculture, industry, and keeping the shipping channels navigable. They lower the reservoir level from its peak of 175 meters down to about 145 meters, which also gets it ready to absorb the next rainy season's flows. This release also helps power the Gazuba Dam further downstream. Since 2003, it's estimated the dam has provided an extra 11 cubic kilometers of fresh water downstream during those critical dry periods.
Right. So flood control and water supply management are key benefits. Let's broaden out again. What about other, perhaps less obvious impacts? Cultural heritage, security.
Yeah, there were significant cultural impacts, too. The area flooded was rich in archaeological sites. There was a massive salvage effort, cost over 500 million yuan. They excavated hundreds of sites, recovered around 200,000 artifacts, with about 13,000 considered particularly important. A lot of that is now in the Chongqing China Sanxia Museum.
But they managed to save quite a bit.
A lot, yes. For larger structures, they couldn't move into a museum. Some were dismantled and rebuilt in special reconstruction districts like open-air parks. But some things just couldn't be saved or moved. Unique geological formations or sites like the ancient hanging coffins high up in some of the tributary gorges, those are now submerged, lost to history.
A real loss.
Yeah.
And security. A structure this big must be a potential target.
That's definitely been considered. Back in 2004, a U.S. Department of Defense report mentioned the dam as a potential high-value target, suggesting that threatening it could be leveraged against China. China strongly objected to that, obviously. There's even been discussion within China about whether an attack on the dam would warrant an exception to their no-first-use nuclear policy, given the potential for catastrophic downstream damage.
Wow, that's serious.
It is, though Chinese experts generally maintain the dam's design. A concrete gravity dam makes it incredibly robust and resistant even to conventional, let alone nuclear attack.
And what about its general structural health? Any concerns there?
There were some initial observations. Right after the reservoir first filled, about 80 hairline cracks were reportedly found in the structure. But an expert panel assessed it and gave it a good quality rating overall. They said the concrete passed quality tests and the deformation observed was within normal limits for such a massive structure settling under load.
Okay. And looking upstream, are there related projects?
Yes, very much so. To make the Three Gorges Dam work even better, particularly managing sediment flow from the upper Yangtze, called the Jinsha River, China has been building a whole cascade of dams further upstream. Big names like Wudongdi, Baiheaton, Zhilodu, Shangyaba, their combined power generation capacity is enormous, about 38,500 megawatts. That's almost double the Three Gorges Dam itself. Baiheaton just became fully operational in 2022.
So the Three Gorges is part of an even bigger system reshaping the entire river?
Precisely. It's the linchpin, but part of a much larger strategy for water management and power generation on the Yangtze.
Okay. We've covered a huge amount of ground here. From the early vision, the immense construction, the power, the navigation, the environmental costs, the human displacement, the flood control benefits. So, wrapping this deep dive up, what's the big picture takeaway on the Three Gorges Dam?
I think it really stands as this monument to human ambition and engineering capability. It delivers vast amounts of power, provides crucial flood protection to millions. Those are undeniable benefits. But as we've seen, it comes at a really significant cost, environmentally, socially, culturally. And many of those impacts are long-term, still playing out. It forces you to confront the complexity of these mega projects. There are rarely simple answers.
Yeah, we've definitely seen the complexities, the controversies, the sheer, almost unbelievable scale of it all.
And maybe it leaves us with a bigger question looking forward. As we face growing energy needs, climate change pressures, what lessons can we really draw from the Three Gorges experience? What does it tell us about the true full-spectrum cost and the real benefits of reshaping our planet on this kind of epic scale?
That's definitely something to think about. A lot to mull over as you continue your own deep dives into the world around us.